okay, going way back my refrigeration days, they would install hard start capacitors. They were called hard start kits, and but not for power, you know, not to save money. That's because, you know, the motors were straining when they would first kick on. You have a certain lock motor amp measurement. Well, it was reaching that, you know, because of whatever reason. And they would get these with a hot start kit. It was actually a capacitor. It looked like a flask somebody would drink whiskey out of, one of those old-fashioned things. That's the look it had, you know. It was pretty big. And it came with a clamp and everything. And it was clamping on these rooftop units, you know. I mean, you would wire it right before it goes into the compressor. And really what it was really two capacitors in one. You know, you had positive, negative, and they were, you know, put the two negatives together. Looking at it, it was just two connections. So, it made up for it. It was actually two capacitors in one. And they used to put that on, but not for saving power or anything. And I never heard of one for a 110 line that you would plug into your house, you know. That I've never heard of that back here.
Yeah, the missing word there was back-to-back. When you take two polarized capacitors, if they're properly rated for that service, and you put them together, the two positives together, and you look at the two negative leads, for instance, is one way of doing it, as a composite capacitor, it now, in theory, is a non-polarized capacitor. Most of your high number of microfarads is an electrolytic capacitor, which means that there's a particular polarity you have to use on each capacitor, and you shouldn't reverse it, otherwise damage takes place. Now, before we go over to Wes, let me go back to you, Paul. I believe you're now talking about the so-called starter capacitor. It turns out that when you've got single-phase power going into a squirrel cage-like rotary motor, in many a circuit, you've got a starting capacitor network. In other words, there's more than one coil in that motor. One coil is the main running coil, and another one is a so-called starter coil. And the starter coil, running on a governor-like mechanism, makes a contact in the beginning before the motor starts, where through the capacitor and the secondary winding as well as the primary winding, you're creating a rotating magnetic field that makes the squirrel cage rotate in a particular direction during the starting operation. Your washing machine motor probably is one of these, where it's got a capacitor start, and once it comes up to speed, the governor disconnects the switch, and the starting capacitor and the secondary coil becomes disconnected, and now you're running on the primary coil because you've already got it up to speed, and you've already told the squirrel cage which direction to rotate. And by the way, if you reverse that wiring, you can make that washing machine motor reverse in the other direction. So that's a starting capacitor, and maybe that's what you're talking about here. And in some of the more elaborate washing machine-like motors have a starting capacitor and a running capacitor. In other words, there's two different values of capacitor for the starting operation and the running operation. I think that's what you're talking about. To use a capacitor as a soft start, to use it as a starting circuit, yes. Does it give you a soft start combination? I'm a little bit skeptical of that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, you ever hear these compressors, they come on and the motor is straining? Well, they used to compensate for that, you know? And this is what they would do. They would put these, and you go to these air conditioning supply houses, and they would, you know, you would order a hard start kit, which was really nothing, bunch of wires, you know, with connectors on them and this capacitor thing. And that's really all it was, with a bracket. They'd give you the bracket, you would bolt it somewhere, the compressor inside these, you know, inside the big box. And they were always like rooftop units. So I guess you could have it in a private house, you know. You know, any central air conditioning system, it would work for that. I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to say 120 microfarads. Does that sound right, Dick? I mean, I'm going back many decades, but does that sound like a right number?
It might be. Some of these starting capacitors are numbers like 60, 100, 150. The capacitor that's inside of the control network of your HAM-M rotator, that is a 120 microfarad AC electrolytic capacitor. And as that particular capacitor dries out and it has less than 120 microfarads, your HAM-M rotator develops less and less torque, and on some particular winter day it won't move at all anymore, and you blame it on the cold weather and you think that the grease has frozen in that HAM-M rotator. I've been through that scene. And in reality, it's really the capacitor that has dried out, it's got the wrong number of microfarads, and it's not turning the rotator. When you've got a full 120 microfarad capacitor in your HAM-M control box, see, corneal dubalier used to be called, and that HAM-M rotator, or the AR-22 rotator, each one of those will produce an amount of torque that, with most cases, will break the ice if it was ice on that bell housing, and if the grease became almost a solid substance because it's a super cold day, that thing can make enough torque. When you got the right size capacitor, it's going to move. So if your HAM-M stops rotating, don't blame it on the cold weather. Don't blame it on the grease getting thick. Check on the size of that capacitor or replace it. So that you could call it, that really is a running capacitor. That capacitor, depending on whether it's made, whether it's connected to coil number one or coil number two, determines whether or not the motor inside the housing turns clockwise or counterclockwise, and therefore you're rotating your antenna in that particular direction. So that's something we've got to check on periodically. Wes, I think you had a comment on this one. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, basically, the solution for what was said is the Kepco bipolar power supply. And when you were talking about the resistive loads or inductive loads or capacitive loads, it operates on the principal basis of the operational amplifier. So it depends from the model, and the company is based on New York, Brooklyn, I believe. They have a high-powered operational amplifier with the full four-quadrant bipolar operation, and the output is capable of both sustaining DC and replication of the arbitrary AC waveform. So in a certain point, you have a sinking and you have a pulling. So yes, it really gives the power back to the grid when it's not used. And they have separate models, so it's not like you have one model for a solution for everything. The inductive loads of Kepco are optimized for driving inductive loads. That's what they say. And the option makes, I'm reading right now, bipolar power supplies suitable for variety of the applications that motor testing, testing of magnetic components, coil speakers, industrial application with inductive loads, driving CRT coils, cryogenic application, and powering the medical imaging devices or accelerators. But then the other model is the capacitive loads, and is optimized for driving capacitive loads, which would be the piezo electric devices, capacitor testing, whatsoever. So, yes, it could be done. The only thing is that no such thing as one solution, although the new model, enter exam, model BOP6-125MG, that's a beauty with the digital display of a big screen like a scope. And this thing is capable for all possible loads, but the price is quite shocking. It's 1 kilowatt series, or even more if you want to. And to exam.
Yeah, I think you're talking about a very special kind of a variable frequency power supply that's used for running a numeric controlled machine, and that's fairly different than what I think Gabe is talking about. But Gabe, I'm fairly sure you don't want to add a capacitor to your 60-cycle line, your 120-volt line at your house. There may be a capacitor in the and the motor circuit of your compressor, and maybe that's something that has to be checked on periodically. There are people who get periodic air conditioner, what's the word for it now, conditioning or a checkup. There are people who, at the beginning of each summer, will make sure that their particular service does a checkup of their air conditioning unit. And one of the things that is checked is that running capacitor inside of the compressor unit, is that capacitor in good shape, and does it require replacement? There are air conditioners that do experience a failure where the motor could become overheated because that capacitor is not running correctly. And so it's kind of sad to burn up an air conditioner because of that particular failure mechanism. There's also something else I want to tell you, and that is many people don't have the proper kind of a interrupt circuit connected to their air conditioner. If an air conditioner is running, and if you interrupt the power going to the air conditioner during the run cycle for something like 1 second, you interrupt the power for something like 1 second and then reestablish the power, you can easily get into what I call the locked rotor condition, where the air conditioner will sit there, hum very loudly, because when it stopped rotating, the amount of freon that was in the piston at that time turned into a liquid. The compressor is trying to compress a liquid, which it cannot do. So until that liquid turns back into the gaseous form, the thing sits there and is in the locked rotor mode. And now there is a thermal overload relay in the motor, which will protect you from that. But you don't want to be using that thermal overload relay, because each time you're opening those current, those contacts at 10 or 20 amperes, you're chipping away those contacts, so to speak. You're beginning to weld them, and eventually there's going to be a failure. It's very similar to using a circuit breaker in the house as an on-off switch. It's not rated for that service, and if you're doing that, it's eventually going to create a failure. So there's a kind of a circuit you can buy, which only costs about $5, as I remember, which will, in the process of sensing a LIPA or a Con Ed interruption for, let's say, 1 second, it will make sure that the power is not allowed to go to the contactor of your air conditioner for the next 60 seconds, so that it waits for that liquid that formed in the compressor piston to evaporate, and then it reestablishes the power, and now you don't have the locked rotor condition, and you're not using up that the very valuable number of cycles that the thermal overload relay inside of the motor can tolerate. Because of the lack of that $5 circuit on a
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Because of the lack of that $5 circuit or $10 circuit on an air conditioner, quite often $1,000 worth of hardware gets burned up, and it's an awful big waste. And so my particular air conditioner, when it was first installed, that wasn't there. I discovered that, added that circuit, and awful glad I did. And my air conditioner right now, I think, is in its 25th year, and has had no other service during all of that time. So it's a very important circuit. So that's much more important than trying to correct for power factor, as I see it. Back to you, Gabe, for any further information. That is KB2MAR, K2RIW.
I was dreaming, really hoping that, well, Wesley was telling me, it sounds like that might be a fix for me, but from what it sounds like, it's a very expensive device to add to the system. I think that's exactly what I read a long time ago about this particular device throwing power back into the system, to the grid. That's exactly what I would want to use for the AC unit, but from what he's telling me, it's probably very expensive. Maybe I won't be able to use it for that particular motorized device. KB2MAR, back to that.
Now, is your main motivation here, Gabe, to save electrical power, make your watt-hour meter run slower, and therefore save money? Are you trying to make your house more efficient? Is that your motivation for this possible capacitor you might add to the line? Back to you, Gabe.
I want the AC unit to run more efficient. Now, as far as for the whole house, I wouldn't attempt to do anything like that. I was just worried about this AC unit, which draws a lot of current, and I was wondering if there's a way to make the unit run more efficient. From what I've heard a while back about putting a capacitor and the system, the current would be thrown back into the grid. Back to you.
I think that's a misunderstanding, Gabe. As long as a 110-volt circuit or 240-volt circuit of an air conditioner is getting the right waveform and the right voltage, in theory, it's going to run correctly. And is there a way that you can now change the amount of real watts that your air conditioner uses? I think the answer is no. I don't think you can change that. And is there a way that you can throw power back to the grid, and therefore your watt-hour meter doesn't run as fast, and therefore you don't pay as many dollars to your power company? I doubt that very highly. When you do find that article, again, Gabe, bring it to our attention, because I think there's a misunderstanding going on here. So there are starting capacitors, running capacitors for certain kinds of motor circuits, and when it comes to a big factory, yes, they put great big capacitors on their power circuit in order to correct for power factor. A homeowner doesn't have to do that. I don't think there is a reasonable way you can make any significant change in the power consumed by your air conditioner. The fact that you're doing this to the air conditioner makes a lot of sense, because it is probably the heaviest power drain device in your house. And the way you, the particular air conditioner you buy, the way it's designed, has a certain EER rating, a certain efficiency rating in the way it was constructed. But once it has been constructed and installed in your house, can you make a change to make it more efficient? I'm very skeptical of that, at least not from the power side of it. By way of you making sure that the condenser coils and the evaporator coils are working correctly and don't have dust jammed in them, and the fans are working correctly. Yeah, there are things along those lines where you can make it more efficient. But from the 60-cycle power point of view, I think the answer is no. When you find that article, please bring it to our attention, Gabe, because there could be a misunderstanding here. Let me...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
I found the article, by the way, that I couldn't think of the guy's call letters. September issue, QST Magazine, on page 76, you'll find this beautiful article called At Ground Zero, and it's written by Bob Heil, Whiskey 2, India Kilowatt. Very well-written article. And so when it comes to being prepared radio-wise for emergencies, you're going to get a lot out of that article. You'll also get an awful lot of impression of what it was like to be at an emergency communication center at Ground Zero in the few days that right after the 9/11 event. The next person on our list was Brett. Brent? Wait a minute. No, it's Bill. Bill was the next person. Alpha Charlie 2, India Sierra. Bill, if you're there, go right ahead. K2RIW in the TechNet. Let me make another call for them. Bill, Alpha Charlie 2, India Sierra. Are you there? K2RIW.
We'll see with the question.
Okay, the next person on the list was Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Alpha Papa. Are you there, sir? K2RIW.
Is definitely on the more basic side of the spectrum, so I apologize to anybody out there for whom this would be elementary. But just curious about balance. I know that it's a balance used to convert a balanced signal from an unbalanced signal. So can you just describe specifically what that means? Let me drop for a second. And also, I know that a balance is used to prevent RF waves from flowing to some line.
Thank you. Ballon, and there are lots and lots of kinds of Ballons. And if you Google those words, guarantee you're going to find quite a few articles on that particular subject, Brandon. A coaxial cable is considered an unbalanced transmission line because, in theory, from the outside world point of view, when you're looking at a coaxial cable, if it's being used correctly, there is no signal on the outside of that cable. All of the signal is on, you could say, the center conductor of the cable, and you could say the outer conductor is just the return of that signal. So all the signal is on the center conductor, but that's considered an unbalanced transmission line. It's just a set of words for describing the way it normally operates, and in theory there should be no RF energy on the outside of it. By comparison, ham radio type 600 ohm open wire line, or the old-fashioned 300 ohm television twin lead that we all used to use, that is a balanced transmission line. In the case of a balanced transmission line, if I was putting a 10 volt signal across that balanced transmission line, and if I really analyze what's happening at each instant of time, at one instant of time, the right-hand wire would be plus 5 volts, and the left-hand wire would be minus 5 volts. And a half a cycle later, those two voltages would be reversing. If I looked at either wire with reference to ground, I would see a sine wave. But if I made a careful measurement, I'd find out that the right-hand wire versus the left-hand wire have the exact same sine wave, but 180 degrees out of phase. So it's the voltage between the two that counts. That's a balanced transmission line. Balanced transmission lines were very popular at one time, particularly because the antennas we usually use, like dipoles, is a balanced antenna. A dipole properly fed, the right-hand side of your dipole at one instant is getting positive energy, and the left-hand side is getting negative energy. You would think you could apply the signal to just the right-hand side of the dipole and not to the left-hand side. Mother Nature doesn't like it that way. She wants the dipole to be fed in a balanced manner. Therefore, if you take your coaxial cable and directly connect the coaxial cable to the dipole, by connecting the center conductor to the right side of the dipole and the shield to the left-hand side, it's not a recommended procedure. You can do it. It's not going to explode. Terrible things are not going to happen, but it's less than ideal because Mother Nature wants that dipole to be fed in a balanced manner. She is going to try to force that balance. Even though you've used an unbalanced transmission line to feed your dipole, Mother Nature is going to try to form a balance. The net result is that the dipole itself will be in this process of its operation because the signal really is bouncing back and forth on that dipole 20 times before it gets radiated into space. And the right electrical length of the dipole makes all of those bounces fall in phase with each other, co-phase, or in step with each other. We call that resonance. So in the present, in the process of the dipole running with its resonance phenomena, it will be pumping current back down the outside of your coaxial cable. And you will get cable current on the outside, and depending on the length of the cable and how close it is to the shack, you could have RF in the shack, even though your cable has got beautifully connected, its connectors are perfectly shielded, the transmitter is perfectly shielded, and yet you'll get what looks like leakage of RF energy in the shack. And there are times when that's a disadvantage. One very simple kind of a balancing device, a so-called poor man's ballon, would be to take a few turns of your coaxial cable as a coil right at the end of the cable where it connects to the antenna. That is constituting an RF choke. You're constructing an RF choke when you do that. So a few turns of the coax cable held together with black tape is a so-called poor man's ballon. When you buy the professional-made device, Unideller, and there's a couple of popular brand names of these things, they do provide a very nice mechanical operation, meaning that you've got the coaxial connector at the bottom of this antenna feeding device. You've got these two nice screw eyes on the side where the dipoles get connected to, and you've got a third screw eye at the top by which you can hang this thing from your tower or tree or whatever. And if you look at what's inside of that, there's a bunch of ferrite toroids, very large ferrite toroids, that are stacked on the outside of the coax cable inside of the package. The coax cable literally runs up the center of this round white package, and there's a bunch of these ferrite, supersized ferrite beads stacked on the outside of the coax cable inside of the package. That is another kind of RF choke. It's kind of hard to believe that you put this ferrite device on the outside of the coax cable, and all of a sudden the cable acts like it's got an RF choke. Now, what you've really done is something very similar to the so-called poor man's balun, where, again, you're creating an RF choke by literally coiling the cable, maybe 2 feet in diameter and 3 turns, something in that order. And by the way, you go to the right page of the radio amateur's handbook, and you know the diameter of the coil and the number of turns of the coil, and you plug it into that particular formula. The formula will tell you how many microhenry is the RF choke you have just created by turning that number of turns of coax cable at the end. And then by another part of the chart there, or you're plugging in the numbers of that number of microhenries and your particular frequency of operation, which might be 14 megacycles, you'll know exactly how many ohms of how many ohms of inductive reactance you've created with that coil. And if, for instance, you've got a 50-ohm cable going into what you think is a 70-ohm antenna, that's a good operation, even though it doesn't sound it, and if that particular coil of yours at your operating frequency has an inductive reactance of 5,000 ohms, which is 100 times higher than 50 ohms, that by my standards is an extremely good RF choke, and even though the dipole itself is trying to launch energy, even though the dipole itself is trying to launch energy back down on the outside of your cable, that choke that you just created, that RF choke, will stop that from happening. As far as the signal is concerned, going down the center of the cable, it doesn't know that it's inside of a coil of an RF choke, if you know what I mean. Because of the way the shielding works, the signal doesn't know the difference, but the choking action takes place. That's one kind of balun. These baluning devices, I just gave you an example of a kind of a very simple balun that will give you the conversion between the unbalanced coaxial cable and your balanced dipole. And you could use it also to feed the driven element dipole of a Yagi antenna. Baluning devices usually are used for unbalanced to balance or balanced to unbalanced operation. There are kinds of baluning devices that literally operate unbalanced to unbalanced or balanced to balanced, but they're doing impedance matching. So in the process of building your balun or buying your balun or analyzing it, you'll see that it can simultaneously give you this RF choking isolation I just described, and it can be giving you impedance matching. The so-called half-wave coax balun does give you a 4-to-1 impedance match. If I took a length of coax cable that's a half wavelength long and bent it into a U shape, and where the top of the U, I connect the shields together, and the two center conductors, I consider them as an output signal device for the balanced output. My main transmission line comes up to that junction of where the U was brought together, so now all three shields are connected together. The center conductor of the transmission line connects to one side of the center conductor of that U, and the other side you don't have to do anything to. So now the two center conductors coming out of the U-shaped piece of cable, I now feed that into, let's say, the dipole. Because of the way the half-wave coax cable operates in that operation, it does give you a 2-to-1 voltage step-up, which is a 4-to-1 impedance step-up. That circuit that I just described, that so-called half-wave coax balun, simultaneously is giving you this unbalanced to balanced operation, and it is converting the 50-ohm impedance of your transmission line into 200-ohm impedance coming out of that balanced structure. So that thing is doing both simultaneously. It's doing impedance matching as well as doing balanced to unbalanced operation. So these are two of the main kinds of balans I just described to you. There's a whole lot of them. Trying to remember, I guess it was FMI, I think it was. All of a sudden, I can't think of his name once again. Somebody just brought that to my attention. He had quite a few articles on the subject. Many of these balans really consist of coils of wire wrapped around toroidal cores. So there's ways that you can do this balance-to-unbalancing operation where the balancing device has no coax cable to it all. Some of them have coax cables inside of them. Some of them do not. Some of them are done with just pieces of wire, usually enameled wire, wrapped onto the core itself. This is a thumbnail sketch about balance, Brandon. Maybe it helps a little bit. And you haven't had enough information to have a warm, fuzzy feeling about it yet. I understand that. You're allowed to ask the question multiple times in multiple weeks. It's a darn good subject. Many of the amateurs don't have a great deal of understanding of these things. There's a lot of mystery about these things. Just doing a raw coax connection to your dipole, as I said, it'll work in a pinch, and it'll work for a long period of time. It's just not the recommended procedure. KD2CAP, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Yeah, thank you very much for that explanation. It's really helpful. It's a good thumbnail. It will enable me to kind of flesh out some more information on the fringes on my own in the next coming week. So appreciate it again. KD2CAP.
Okay, go ahead, Eric.
I don't know if I missed this, but I had to go kick one or two pieces for a second. But anyway, in talking about balanced lines, have you ever talked about balanced audio and what the advantage of balanced audio over unbalanced audio is? Because you always talk about all that.
Hold on now, Eric. Is there anything of value that's not RF? Oh, that's a joke. In the case of broadcast, where Eric has worked for a whole lot of years, to really make clean audio from a broadcast studio, where you're not getting hum pickup and clicking noises from all the operating electronics around, to have really clean broadcast quality audio along with a really clean broadcast quality video, a lot of heroic effort is required. And some of that is called balanced audio. Why don't you give us a few words on what's required to do that in order to get rid of all of these extraneous signals that want to climb onto your valuable audio circuits? What do you guys have to do to keep that purity, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. Well, you know, the principle of balanced line is the same. So when we talk about audio, we talk about common modes of rejection. And basically, instead of having a single-ended amplifier, we'll take an op-amp and use both the positive input and the negative input. You can induce hum on the wire and put all sorts of garbage on the wire, and it has no effect because of the common mode rejection.
Now, I'm going to make a guess that your actual wiring that goes from point A to point B, if you've got to go through, let me pick a number, 20 feet of wiring, that in some cases you're either running two pieces of coax cable side by side, or it is a dual center conductor coax cable as part of what we're discussing here. So two center conductors on a coax cable is actually doing the transmission. But more importantly, the sending circuit and the receiving circuit for the audio going down that dual conductor is used in a balanced manner. If the particular audio he's putting on that line right now is a 2-volt audio, the right-hand wire is getting plus 1 volt, the left-hand wire is getting minus 1 volt at that instant of time. And it's kept in a thoroughly balanced manner on the sending end. The receiving end circuit looks at the differential of the voltage between the right-hand wire and the left-hand wire. It is only looking at differential voltage, and that receiving circuit is thoroughly immune to any common mode voltage. The reason why some of this is important is that good common sense would lead you to believe that your coaxial cable, properly used, has got, let me pick a number, 100 decibels of shielding as far as the RF energy. As far as the RF energy that wants to flow from the center of the cable to the outside world. Your RG8U piece of cable, or RG214, the double shielded version of it, at, let me pick a number, 80 meters or 14 or 20 meters, has got something like 100 decibels of shielding. Common sense would lead you to believe that if you took that coaxial cable and used it at an audio frequency, you'd like to believe you're going to continue to get 100 decibels of isolation. Absolutely not. That 60 cycle signal has a depth of penetration. As you go to lower and lower frequencies, the skin effect starts working against you. The depth of penetration through the outer braid of that coax cable starts getting really significant, and the amount of shielding you get from the fact that your cable ran alongside of a 60-cycle transformer that's radiating a strong magnetic field, and you'd like to think your coax cable is going to give you 100 dB of shielding. It might give you 5 dB of shielding. That 60-cycle magnetic wave is walking right through the cable. When you use the cable in the differential manner, you're now creating a common mode voltage on those two wires, and your receiving circuit will ignore it. Is that part of what we're talking about here, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
No, that's exactly what we're talking about. We can do it with transformers, we can do it with op-amps, we can do it with pairs of amplifiers. And typically in audio, by the way, most, when you see a microphone on a stage, you'll see a microphone that actually has a balanced output. It's got, from its transducer, it goes into a transformer, which is basically a center tap transformer on the secondary. Its output impedance is 600 ohms. It goes into not a piece of coax, but it goes into something that looks sort of like a coax. What it really is a shield with two twisted wires inside of it. Those twisted wires, and actually in the old days they weren't even twisted, the average impedance of that piece of cable is 600 ohms. So, you've got a signal that is at, you know, maybe 20 millivolts or 40 millivolts that you may be taking to 100 feet of cable to go into the differential input of this input amplifier, and because that signal is so low and so weak, it's susceptible to picking up any kind of garbage. That's one of the reasons why we use balanced lines. And in the old days, it was either 150 ohms or 600 ohms, and today it's pretty much 600 ohms. Interestingly enough, with digital audio, it's actually 110 ohms that we use, which is a different kind of standard. But that's precisely the reason. And it's all differential. And that eliminates all the common mode junk that you can pick up to a major, major degree. I mean, you can kill it if you do some weird stuff, but in normal, real-world applications, it looks just great.
When it comes to industrial applications these days, industrial environment, where you've got a zillion computers in the building and you want all of those computers to be talking to each other, tremendous amounts of wiring in the average industrial environment consists of Cat 5 cable, Category 5 cable, or maybe 5A or 6A cable. But if you actually look at a piece of Category 5 cable, Cat 5 cable, you'll see a total of 8 wires arranged in 4 twisted pairs. Each of those twisted pairs have a different twist rate, but those twisted pairs of wires, of the 8 wires that are in a particular cable, if I pick up wire number 1 and number 2, so to speak, that are twisted together, and I consider them my signal number 1, and if I use them in a differential manner on the sending end and the receiving end, and that Cat 5 cable does not have a shield on the outside. It's got a nice rubber coating on the outside to protect it from weather, but there is, in many cases, no outer shield. Properly used, that twisted pair acts like it's a coaxial cable. As long as you've got thoroughly differential input and output circuits on the sending end and the receiving end, and even though that circuit is running alongside of the motor of an air conditioner and another motor of a fan for the building, and a great big power transformer, even though it's running by all of these things that could ordinarily couple tremendous amounts of undesired signal onto that cable magnetically and electrostatically, because the cable is used in a differential manner, most of the time it gives you no grief. It can send megacycle rate type signals, hundreds of megacycle rate signals down that cable, and it acts like it's thoroughly shielded, even though it's just two wires twisted together. Wonder if you got some words on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. That's absolutely right. But some people put Cat 5 cables together and wonder why they have all the trouble. Is that there's actually a specific manner in which you connect those wires to the pins. And if you disrupt the way it should be differentially sent down the twisted pair, which some people do by not following the rule, you get into all sorts of difficulties. You know what the difference between Cat 5 or Cat 5E and Cat 6 is? That's a cool one.
Go right ahead, Eric. Sounds good.
Cat 5 or Cat 5E, they try to maintain capacitance between each of the pins, and it's rather difficult. So it gives you a bandwidth limitation as to how fast you can send a pulse down there and try and keep the edges square. What they do in Cat 6 is there's actually a spacer that looks like a plus sign, and each of those pairs fit into the corner of that plus sign, so it's sort of like you've got a little bit of dielectric. It really is more a physical thing, which keeps the separation between the pairs consistent throughout the length of the cable. So if you bend it, you twist it, you don't create too many disruptions. If you look at the, if you do a comparison of putting a kink in a Cat 5 cable with a TDR and look at it with a Cat 6 cable with a TDR, it's a world of difference. The reason for Cat 6 cable is because as we go to gig E or 10 gig E, you have to maintain the capacitance between those conductors to try and keep the ride time within the specifications is what's required. K2RW, K2J.
Our Cat 6 cable, is that good for at least 1,000 megahertz data rate, Eric? Go ahead.
Cat 6 cable is not absolutely necessary at gig E, but it's positively necessary at 10 gig E. The other thing that you've got to consider is when we, once we get into the gig E and that kind of stuff, it's no longer just a pair of transmission and receive lines, which like Cat 5, you know, 100 base T or 100 base, your typical 100 base cable. You actually are splitting the data up between those four pairs, so you don't actually send the 10 gigs down the one pair of cable because that ain't never going to happen.
That makes some sense. So you break it up spectrally. Each of the twisted pair are taking a fraction of that whole data rate. Now, one of the things that Eric touched on earlier is that, let's assume now that my particular Cat5-like cable consists of four wires instead of eight, just to keep it simple. And wire number one and number two, they might be green and green with a white stripe, or white with a green stripe and green are the two wires for wires number one and two. And maybe wires number three are again white with an orange stripe and orange. And so you're intending to send differential signals down one and two and a second signal pair, differential signals down number three and four. And if you reverse the wiring in some crazy way where your first pair is number one and three and your second pair is number two and four, if you miswire the connector that way and you check from end to end with your ohmmeter, you'll think everything's hunky-dory. But because the twisted pair of number one and two are not being used for signal number one, you're using a weird combination between the two. All of a sudden, you're using the cable in an unconventional manner, and your frequency response will become terribly smaller, a hell of a lot worse. Your hum pickup will be a lot worse. You're not using the fact that twisted pair one and two have a certain twist rate that gives them a certain amount of isolation. Twisted pair number three and four have a different twist rate, and they've got their isolation. And now you mix up those pairs, and you're not going to get that isolation. You're not going to get that shielding characteristic, and some terrible things have happened. I wonder if you've heard stories along those lines, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yes, I had the experience of a electrician's union being required in New York City to put connectors on cables and run cables. And they were given, of course, a cable checker, which you put a device on one end, which sequences the signals down the pins of the connector, and an idiot light at the other end. And they did an entire plant wrong. And nothing worked very well.
What was required to correct that? Do they have to chop off the connectors on each end and rewire every one of those to make it come out right? Eric, go ahead.
That's correct. That was over 10,000 connectors.
That created how many delta dollars in delta time? In other words, somebody lost how many dollars because of that error, and it held you up how many hours of time, Eric Grant?
Five weeks. The union had to provide the labor. So, it cost time, which is equal to dollars, but the labor cost got absorbed.
Okay. I know you don't have the whole story, Brandon, but we're going to move on. I know that Jim wanted to ask a question, if he's still there. KD2BHY, K2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, hi, Dick. Today I had a question because I was on HF earlier, and I had a question about dipole. What my question was is, how many... I've always oriented my dipole so that they were flat, or I haven't tried inverted Z, but I know that works. But like, how many can you invert? Like, can you put a dipole in different positions and it won't affect the SWR?
Yeah, there's really more than one question you're asking, and that's perfectly right, Jim. And there's more than one answer on this one. When you're sending a signal out on 80 through 10 meters, the HF frequencies, and most of the time the signal you're sending out, you're not talking to somebody that's 3 miles away where there's a direct signal from your antenna to his antenna. Most of the time you're talking to guys much, much greater distances where you are using the ionosphere. Once the signal bounces off the ionosphere, whatever polarization it goes into the ionosphere and comes back out on, in almost all cases, is not the same. The ionosphere is going to twist the polarization of the signal. Your horizontally polarized signal going into the ionosphere, bouncing off of it and going over to your buddy in London is probably twisting a couple of times, and when it comes out of the ionosphere and it hits him in London, your horizontally polarized signal might be vertical to him. And when he sends back a vertical signal, it doesn't mean it's going to become horizontal to you. Because the crazy way the ionosphere behaves is it doesn't obey reciprocity. The twist it has from going east to west and the twist it creates going west to east is not the same twist. So, therefore, you don't have to have a particular favored polarization when it comes to talking to a particular guy. Item number one. Item number two, the dipole itself, if it was in free space, whether the dipole is horizontal, vertical, slanted 45 degrees to the right, or slanted 45 degrees to the left. In free space, every one of those dipoles will behave with equal efficiency, equal performance, per se. That's the good news. Now, when you put your dipole into a real environment, where maybe it's partially parallel to the gutters of the house, or the downspout of the house, or it's even though you don't see the wiring of the house, the dipole is laying on top of the roof, and it's a small distance away from the wiring that goes through the roof of the house, or, you know, the upper floor. And so it's got nearby metallic objects. Half of the dipole is buried in the middle of a tree, and the tree is providing some extra capacitance to ground. One end of the dipole is close to ground, giving you some extra capacitance. All of these things will disturb the tuning of the dipole. And if you're smart enough to readjust the lens or use the right kind of an antenna tuner, 90-some-odd percent of the time, the fact that you've disturbed the dipole can be corrected. So a dipole that is near objects that it shouldn't be near doesn't stop it from operating. It creates a problem, but the problem is a solvable problem. And can you reorient it? That's the right way to go. Should the dipole be exactly parallel to the ground? It doesn't have to be. It can be a V, an inverted V. The dipole itself can be zigzagged. The end can be curved up and down. You can do all kinds of things. Let me drop. The RF energy, which in some cases is very persnickety, in those cases on the dipole itself, you'll be amazed how tolerant the RF energy is. As long as the dipole has the right electrical resistance, electrical resonant frequency to it, and you can find that out with the right kind of a piece of test equipment, an antenna or a tester of some kind. Your standing wave ratio meter is one way of finding out. As you sweep the frequency and plot the standing wave ratio, and you look at the bathtub-shaped curve, and at the bottom of the bathtub in the middle of the band that you care about, that tells you whether or not the dipole is electrically too long or too short. And by the way, as I take a dipole that in free space is exactly the right length, and now I put it in your particular environment, and it might electronically act like it's too long, and you have to shorten it physically to bring it back into resonance in your particular environment. That's particularly all right. So there's a lot of things you can do with a dipole, and you don't have to feed it in the center. You can feed it off to one side if you're smart enough with using the right kind of balancing device and impedance matching device. So the dipole itself is very tolerant. About the only thing you really got to worry about is how close to the ground it is and whether or not it's in a shielded environment. If you're on the 80-meter band, and if your dipole is only 10 feet above the ground, you've built a NVIS antenna, N-V-I-S, Near Vertical Incident Skywave. In other words, because the signal bouncing off the ground that's so close to the dipole, and because that ground at your RF frequencies is almost a perfect mirror, you've got a real dipole above the ground, you've got a mirror image of the dipole below the ground. That's a fancy way of saying the signal that bounces off the Earth, how does it act? It acts as if it's coming from a second dipole that's the equal distance below the ground as your real dipole above the ground. The bottom line of all that is that if your dipole is in wavelength too close to the ground, your elevation angle coming off the dipole will be a signal that's going almost straight up. And if you only want to talk to a guy that's a small distance away, and if the ionosphere is reflecting that kind of a signal today, it can work. But a NVIS signal usually is a very short-range communication. So angle of takeoff of the signal in elevation from your dipole is a function of how many wavelengths it is above the ground. So altitude, because of that factor, is quite important. And if you're mounting the dipole in such a place that it's in the backyard of a bunch of tall buildings, and those buildings are acting like a shield, that's going to give you some grief. So shielding effects and altitude above the ground, you got to worry about that a little bit. But other than that, being near gutters of the house, being near the wiring of the house, buried in a tree, all of those characteristics that to your eye look bad, electronically, most of the time you can retune for that, Jim, and make it work like a charm. KD2BHY, K2RIW in the deck, man.
Okay, thanks, Dick. That was a really good explanation. I was setting up a dipole earlier this week, and I was wondering if maybe, because it was a little bit close to the ground, the 20 meters, it was about 5 or 10 feet above the ground, and I was seeing if I could get it a full wavelength above the ground, but I was wondering how I could orient it so that it would still be a dipole and would still work, and that really helped me out. Back to next.
Yeah, most of the time the performance of a dipole is primarily determined by the altitude above the ground. And by way of a slingshot, bow and arrow and whatever, putting a monofilament line above the tree and using it to tow up your dipole, that's a very good thing to do. And when you put the dipole up in the tree, you think the dipole has to be suspended by two separate trees and be parallel to the ground. Well, if you don't have a second tree and the dipole is hanging nearly vertical, that's not bad. The dipole doesn't have to be parallel to the ground. You don't have to transmit pure horizontal signal, because by the time the guy gets the signal, it ain't going to be purely horizontal, no matter what you do. So don't worry about orientation. Worry about the average altitude, the center of the dipole, so to speak. If that's the right number of wavelengths above the ground, even if the dipole is vertical or horizontal, that's what really determines the majority of your vertical takeoff angle, as they say, angle of elevation. So altitude, there's three things to make a dipole work well, Jim. Altitude, and altitude. That's a slight exaggeration, but I think you see where I'm going on that one. Come on back next week and ask us some more questions. Now, we've been delayed an awful lot, but let's go to the mailbag, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick, everyone on the net. Okay, got a couple of good questions here, but I know Paul is going to need a lot of time because I expect to hear a lot from him and a lot of information. So I'll touch on this first question. Now, this young ham has a couple of pieces of equipment. One is an RF field strength meter. Now, he wants to draw the response curve on a piece of graph paper which he knows he has to have amplitude and frequency. But he wants to know the proper setup on the RF bench. He has an old ICO RF generator that he's going to use as his signal, and he has a military filtering meter. So he wants to draw that curve, so maybe you could give him a suggestion on how to set up an RF test bench and go through that procedure. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Hey, John, that's a beautiful question, a beauty of a question. I'll warn you, this one's not easy. If this is the best of all worlds, you've got a field strength meter, which reads out in units of volts per meter. Those are the real units of field strength, volts per meter. You can look at any of the FCC specifications for electromagnetic interference and signal strength on the undesired frequencies coming out of a piece of equipment, all of this kind of jazz. Usually it's rated in units of volts per meter of radiated signal. And the problem is, when you're testing an antenna, or you're testing a field strength meter, naively you think you're testing an antenna. You're not. You're testing the antenna simultaneously. You're testing the environment the antenna is in. That environment is reflecting signals, and the reflected signal going between point A and point B means you've got a direct signal through the air, you've got an indirect signal that's making one or a zillion bounces, and maybe there's a zillion ways the signal is bouncing, and all of those bounce signals plus the direct signal all add together at the receiving antenna in a vector manner. Vector manner means that you take the amplitude of each of the signals and the phase angle of the signals, and you could say you're adding them together on a piece of polar graph paper. That's what's really happening. As such, you've got to really be careful about what environment you're making the measurement in. To make the measurement inside of your laboratory of a field strength meter is not easy. You have to do some heroic things to find out whether or not you've controlled the reflections of the environment. If this is the best of all possible worlds, you'd be doing that test inside of an anechoic chamber. Let me drop. An anechoic chamber is this great big room with these great big pyramids of resistive absorbing material so that there is no reflections in that room per se. The room acts like free space. A well-tuned anechoic chamber will allow your equipment to think that it's in outer space, a zillion miles away from the Earth, and you're really making a completely free space measurement. That would be the nicest way to do calibration of a field strength meter. So if you want the measurement to be traceable to the Bureau and accurate, then that's what's required. Now, don't let that scare you. We amateurs don't have to have three decimal places of accuracy. If you're doing a calibration procedure of your field strength meter, and you think you're giving it one millivolt per meter of signal strength, in reality, because of the reflections off your bench and off the wall, you're really giving it 8/10 of a millivolt instead of 1 millivolt because you're getting partial cancellation. That's not a showstopper. You know that the calibration curve you're going to come up with has a certain error to it, and you're not going to try to use it to the third decimal place. So out in the backyard, where you've got more free space, I think you're going to get a better calibration than you do indoors. To calibrate a field strength meter indoors without using an anechoic chamber, I'm just letting you know that there's a bit of a minefield there. There's a lot of ways you can get quite a bit of error to the measurement. That being said, now how do you really do it? Once you know that you're transmitting a signal from point A, and you know the gain of that particular antenna, if it's a dipole, it's got 2.14 dB over isotropic as its gain. And also by way of the formulas that represent free space. Let me drop. You make the assumption that your dipole is acting like a light bulb in the middle of a spherical room. A light bulb, a real good light bulb in the middle of a spherical room, if it's a 100-watt light bulb, and if the area of your spherical room has 100 square meters to it, then by definition, each square meter is going to receive 1 watt because of the inverse square law. In other words, that signal is spreading out as a spherical wave equal in all directions, and once you know the distance between the light bulb and the 1 square meter that you're measuring on the room, once you know that distance and you plug it into the formula 4 pi r squared, That's the area of a sphere. Once you know the radius of the sphere, which is really your distance in this case, and you multiply by 4 pi, you know the ratio of the area of the room, and you know that in the case of an isotropic antenna like that light bulb, it's evenly smearing the power all over the place. So once you know the distance between your transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna, and you know the gain of the transmitting antenna, you now can calculate how strong is the signal in watts per meter at your receiving site. And if the receiving site antenna has a known gain, which means it has a known area, you can figure out how much signal it's going to pick up if everything's working right. And if now if your instrumentation connected to that receiving antenna gives you that number of millivolts or microvolts, then everything has been pretty nicely confirmed. So before you go through the procedure, let me drop of moving your signal generator every 10 kilohertz across a whole lot of megacycles and spend a whole lot of hours making data and recording it, before you go through that procedure, my strongest recommendation is the very first measurement you make in the center of the band at your given power level into the transmitting antenna and your particular range to the receiving antenna, and you look at some number of millivolts or microvolts of received signal. Before you proceed, do a couple of back-of-the-envelope calculations. It is the very first reading that you get within the ballpark. If your calculation is that you're supposed to get 1 millivolt of signal, and you measure 30 microvolts of signal, which I would call a huge error, a 33-to-1 error, don't bother taking 40,000 more pieces of data, which is going to have the same error wrapped into it. Find out what's going on. Does it have a blown front-end amplifier? Is the antenna properly connected? Is it properly impedance matched? Is the circuit being fed the right amount of B-plus voltage? If it's running on battery, is the battery running correctly? Is the meter damaged, and so on? So make sure the very first reading you make is within the ballpark of a calculation. These are some of the things that can save a lot of grief, and I'm telling you a little bit about where the minefield is. It's a fairly difficult measurement in the real world because you think you're measuring a field strength meter. You're really measuring the field strength meter plus all the stuff that's around it. Oh, you, John, KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Yes, very good. I do have some suggestions for him, though, because he's looking to just get relative field strength to be able to see the differences. Okay, so he doesn't need to have it accurate or to know exactly how many millivolts should be there. That's fine. When you do a general calibration and you're going to draw that graph, what I found is you're right. You do it outside. You leave your attenuator on your generator set. Take your readings. You can graph that out. Then double the distance if you have enough sensitivity. If not, then you work it out differently. And do it again. If it falls within the same area, you're pretty close to a relative reading. And then you could do what you suggested, but I think that's a little more than he's asking for. But good points, and I'm sure now he can research and find out exactly what you're talking about, because you and I have done this before, and it's not as easy as it sounds. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I like that double check of yours, John. By doubling the distance and see if what you get is reasonable. If it was a perfect world and this was a free space environment and the ground reflection wasn't giving you a lot of grief, and there's ways you can control that, when you double the distance, you should get 1/4 the power, which is equal to 1/2 the voltage. Every time you double the distance, you should be getting 1/2 the number of volts and millivolts per meter if everything was hunky-dory. So once again, is it falling into the ballpark before you proceed? So distance and voltage have a nice linear relationship. Distance and power have the square law relationship because power is voltage squared. Or, as you can tell in the case of the light bulb in the spherical room, if I made the room twice as big in all dimensions, it's got 4 times as much area, therefore each square meter is going to get 1/4 of the power. That's sort of a little bit better feeling for where is the inverse square law coming from. Back to you, John, if you want to go to the next one. KC2WGB, K2RAW.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, we'll take one more and then we'll get to the poll before we lose him. This is a question. I'm going to have to give you a description of the construct and then you can tell me what's happening. This is a capacitor question. Let me let it drop. Okay, we have a copper plate, not copper, aluminum, whatever, which is one side of a capacitor. It's a square, 100 millimeters by 100 millimeters, and that has a wire connected to it, of course. We have another capacitor, another plate for the capacitor, same element, and it is 50 millimeters by 50 millimeters. Okay, and there's a wire attached to that. And the separation, let's say, is 10 millimeters. Now, we have a specific amount of capacitors, and we can place a charge on this. So now his question is, let me let it drop. One plate is larger than the other. All right? How does that affect capacitors if it does? We're not moving the distance, but if now we reduce the large plate to the same size as the smaller plate, how does that affect the capacitor? How does that affect charge and the value of the capacitor itself? If I describe this, I changed it a little bit.